Good morning. The next matter on the calendar is Bobby Vanderveer versus Audio Homes, Inc., and the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Counsel for relator, when you're ready, you may proceed. And both counsel, when you reach the podium, please identify yourselves for us.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. My name is Tucker Chambers, and I'm appearing today on behalf of the relator, Bobby Vanderveer. We are here today to ask this court to reverse the unemployment law judge's determination that Ms. Bobby Vanderveer quit her employment without good reason. Of the two issues on appeal, I'll start very briefly with the first issue of whether Ms. Vanderveer quit or was discharged, and then I'd like to focus the majority of my argument on whether Ms. Vanderveer had a good reason to quit. First, the ULJ's determination of a quit is not reasonably supported by the record. Rather, the record supports that Ms. Vanderveer was indefinitely suspended following the staff meeting on September 12, 2017. At that time, Ms. Vanderveer was told she could not return to work until she completed an indefinite and unspecified training without any details or scheduling of the training at the time. This qualifies as an indefinite suspension under Minnesota Statute 268.095, Subdivision 5. Now, Ms. Vanderveer did decline the training at that time, as she did not think she needed it and called her work environment too toxic. But the record supports that she did not say at that time, "I quit," or "I do not want further employment." And this is consistent with her follow-up just 2 weeks later on September 29th, asking when the training was going to be scheduled. But her employer declined to schedule it and said more time would be needed. Ultimately, the training was never scheduled. This simply does not satisfy the statutory requirement for a quit. Specifically, the decision to end the employment at the time the employment ended must be the employee's. Here it was the contrary. It was the decision of her employer to indefinitely suspend Ms. Vanderveer at that meeting on September 12th without any scheduling or details on the vague training. Now, whether Ms. Vanderveer quit or was discharged is unnecessary to decide by this court. If this court determines under its de novo review that Ms. Vanderveer quit with a good reason. And it is undisputed on appeal, both sides agree this is a de novo review that this court applies to that second issue. Now there are four statutory elements, that the reason is directly related to the employment, that it's adverse to the worker, and that it would cause a reasonable average worker to quit. And the fourth requirement is that the worker must have complained to the employer about those adverse conditions to give a reasonable opportunity to address it. Now here, all of those requirements are satisfied, and the record supports that. Ms. Vanderveer's reasons for quitting were adverse, they were directly involved in her employment, and they would compel an average worker to quit. And those reasons included specifically abusive and harassing treatment by residents of the group home in which she worked, such as calling her names, punching staff members, and purposefully spreading feces around Ms. Vanderveer's workplace.
Mr. Chambers, can I go back to that first, the quit issue? You mentioned she did not use the word quit, and would you agree the law does not require her to, but instead the findings of the judge that we give discretion to under the circumstances, including that you need more training, and essentially she said it's too toxic here. Would that not be a reasonable finding that we would have to affirm that that was her decision to quit, notwithstanding not using the words?
Our position, Your Honor, is that looking at the record as a whole, that was not a reasonable conclusion by the ULJ. Your Honor is correct. There is, you know, discretion to the ULJ's factual findings and particularly any credibility determinations, but that discretion is not unlimited. And our position is there was never the decision at the time the employment ended had to be Ms. Vanderveer's. And simply saying it's toxic here, our position is that's essentially a continuation of her complaints to the employer about the adverse conditions. These conditions are toxic. Please fix them. Please address them.
I understand that was combined, though, with her declining to do the training. I'm not doing the training. It's too toxic here. And then she leaves. It was both, if I understand correctly.
That's correct, Your Honor. But our position is you also have to combine that with the other facts just 2 weeks later that she's asking about that training. When is that training going to be scheduled? And our position is those statements at that meeting, those were simply her complaints, her demands to please address these very toxic and unsafe conditions. And she didn't think she needed that training at the time. because that training was not going to fix the malicious behavior by the residents, including the name.
The transcript that I'm looking at addendum 37, indicates that at the hearing when she was asked, about Ms. Audio's testimony. She was told Ms. Audio testified that you said at this point that this environment was too toxic and you didn't want to work there anymore. Did you say that? And she said, I think I did say that, but I did not say that I did not want to be employed there anymore. And then if we go on to the next page, we find out that when she talked with the employer about staying on, she indicated that she asked if she could stay, and this is her testimony. I asked if I could stay and if I could just be like a driver or something. So it seems as though she just didn't want her, she didn't want to work in that position that she considered to be too toxic. How do you get around that testimony?
Two responses to that, Your Honor. First, regarding addendum 37, the answer at the end of that page, I think there's only one reasonable reading of that. So the question is, Ms. Audio testified that you said the environment was, number one, too toxic, and number two, you didn't want to work there anymore. Ms. Vanderveer gives two responses to those two questions. One is, I think I did say that, referring to the point about toxicity, it was too toxic, but I did not say, I did not want to be employed there anymore. That's answering the second point of the question.
So you say, take that as a denial that she said she didn't want to work there anymore.
Precisely, Your Honor.
Okay.
And our position is that's the only reasonable way to read that. And in terms of your second question regarding addendum 38, we think the only reasonable reading of that is if she's asking to work there as a driver, that's essentially affirming I want to continue to work with you. I want to continue working with Audio Homes. But this current environment, working with these malicious behaviors, that's too toxic for me. Is there alternative duties that I can take on to continue working here? Is the way that I would read that.
Now, Mr. Chambers, would it be an accurate reflection of the findings of the ULJ, if I understood in looking at the findings, that she quit and then changed her mind, which was the resurrection of the subsequent email? But she had quit, thought about it, changed her mind.
Our position is that's not a reasonable reading of the record, and I'd like to refer back to the statute that I mentioned earlier about the definition of a discharge, and that's statute 268.095, and that's subdivision 5A and B. A discharge includes a suspension of an indefinite duration. So our position is that she was suspended without pay for an indefinite duration as of September 12th, when the employer said, you can't work here anymore unless you get a training. Immediately, there's an indefinite suspension without pay. And merely because Ms. Vanderveer says she declined the training at that time and complains about it being too toxic, when looked at the record as a whole, at 2 weeks later, she's asking, when's that training going to be? I think the reasonable reading is there. Yes, she declined training right away. That doesn't mean she quit, that the decision to end her employment was hers and that she didn't want to work there anymore. But if I may pivot to the second issue about quitting with a good reason, because if the court on its de novo review agrees with our position on that point, it's not necessary to resolve the quit versus discharge question. As I mentioned earlier, the behaviors of the residents, including the name calling and the malicious, you know, spreading of feces, those under the statute and under the case law of this court constitute adverse conditions that would compel a reasonable average person to quit. We cited a number of cases, that's on page 12 of our opening brief, where actions of coworkers, such as name-calling, rude behavior, slamming doors, those can be sufficient adverse reasons compelling an average worker to quit. It doesn't have to be the employer itself, just like it can be coworkers, it could also be residents. of a group home.
But isn't there a distinction? Because if you're dealing with coworkers, they are presumably subject to the supervision and control of the employer. So if a coworker is harassing other coworkers, the employer could terminate that coworker. The same can't be said when you're dealing with mentally ill individuals in a group home who are presumably in the group home because they have no control over their behavior. So aren't the two sets of circumstances meaningfully distinguishable? In other words, is there any evidence that indicates that there is something the employer could have done that would have changed the behavior of the residents?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Yes to both questions. I think the cases are...
What does the record show that the employer could have done to eliminate the behavior of the residents?
Well, Ms. Vanderveer made several suggestions herself.
Closing them off out back?
That was one...
Because that we've got a case that says that's abuse.
The record supports Ms. Vanderveer said that, but we would not submit that that would be a way to address the issue.
Well,
what would the employer have done
to change the behavior of the residents?
Certainly. Ms. Vanderveer made a few other suggestions about how to improve it. One is potentially adjusting the medications that the patients are taking. If they're not working well, if malicious behavior...
Is she a physician?
No, she's not a physician. A couple other suggestions, there was mention of staffing. The workload of the night shift versus the day shift, perhaps it was insufficient, and her supervisor, Jim Hammer, disagreed with her on that and refused to consider it. Another suggestion was, beyond the hosing comment, there's also a comment about simply moving this resident to a different facility that may be better equipped to handle his needs. Now, the record supports there was only one or two employees working at a time in this entire group home. And so that is a potential way to resolve it, changing staffing or moving this resident to another facility. It is undisputed, these behaviors by this resident are undisputed, that this was happening, this
Does spreading. The record show that any other employees of the group home left employment because of behavior of the residents?
The record doesn't show that one way or the other. Now, the record is clear that Ms. Vanderveer did raise these issues that she was having with the residents, both at that September 12th meeting and prior to that meeting, and provided several suggestions, including the ones we just discussed, about changing staffing or moving the resident to try to address those conditions, which were unsafe, which were adverse, and which would compel a reasonable employee to quit if they weren't addressed. But the record is clear that nothing was done, no actions were taken, and no reasonable assurances were provided to Ms. Vanderveer that resident's behaviors would be addressed.
Does the record indicate to whom she went and to whom, and is that critical to the conclusion as to whether it was cause?
It is relevant, Your Honor, and the record is clear that, number one, that she complained to everyone at that staff meeting on September 12th, but also she testified that she raised her complaints with Mr. Hammer, her supervisor, prior to September 12th. And case law does provide, such as the Monroe Holding v. Cook case, that it is sufficient to complain to a supervisor, and then the knowledge of the adverse conditions are imputed to the employer. So that would be imputed through Mr. Hammer. And the case law is also clear that a reasonable opportunity does need to be provided to the employer. But as long as she's raising these complaints with Mr. Hammer, both at the meeting and prior to the meeting, and she's given no reasonable assurances or expectation that those issues are going to be resolved, then that satisfies the reasonable opportunity requirement. And one example of that is the TruStone case that we cited. There has to be some type of reasonable expectation that the complaints are going to be addressed. And when those complaints are rejected and all that's offered is, you know, pinning the blame on the employee and saying, you need training, then that satisfies that requirement. Now, if I could briefly address the unemployment law judge's findings. And one critical error in particular was the application of the standard for adverse conditions that would cause a reasonable employee to quit. The ULJ essentially dismissed Ms. Vanderveer's complaints about the harassment, name-calling, spreading of feces because she did not, quote, fear for her safety. We want to be clear, that's not the standard. Fear for safety is not in the statute. It's not in the case law. And all of the cases we cited, such as rude behavior, name-calling, and this is on page 12 of our brief, those wouldn't be considered physically unsafe conditions. They just have to compel a reasonable employee to quit. And even if that were the standard and it's not, there actually is support in the record. Ms. Van Der Veer did fear for her safety. It's on Exhibit 3, Addendum 45. She stated that she believed the work environment was unsafe. I believe that was in response to the request for information. So taking all this together, the court should hold Ms. Van Der Veer had a good reason to quit caused by her employer, and that she is eligible for unemployment benefits. Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Froelich. I represent the respondent in this case, the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development. And we ask this court to affirm the decision of the unemployment law judge as it is legally and factually correct. Ms. Bobby Van Der Veer worked in a group home with vulnerable adults who had serious mental illnesses. After she stated to the owner and other people, other employees, that a resident should be hosed down and another resident should go to jail, the owner decided that Ms. Van Der Veer needed additional training in order to adequately handle the vulnerable adult's behaviors. Rather than accept this training, which would help her interact with the vulnerable adults, she said that she did not want to work at this place anymore and quit the employment. That does not amount to a good reason caused by the employer for quitting. Now, the evidence in the record reasonably tends to support the ULJ's conclusion that Ms. Van Der Veer quit the employment. And whether Ms. Van Der Veer quit is indeed a finding of fact that is subject to deference. As Judge Shellhaus noted earlier, Ms. Van Der Veer admitted to stating that the work was too toxic and she didn't want to work in that place anymore. I disagree that it can be reasonably construed to kind of dissect that as two separate responses to the judge's question. And it certainly can be read in a way that says that she admitted to saying that she did not want to work in that place anymore. And that's on the transcript at page 27. Whether or not she says, I'm formally ending my employment or I am quitting at this time, those words aren't necessary. The evidence in the record shows that she was offered additional training and that she said she did not want that training. She is allowed to continue working if she takes the training. She says, no, that's a choice to end the employment.
Ms. Froelich, how does that distinguish from the point Mr. Chambers made that it would be equivalent of a suspension? Because it sounds like that issue came up for the first time, the need for training, at this meeting where she made that somewhat shocking comment, and that's what then led to the requirement that you need to do training. And I understand she wasn't due to work back for some days anyway, and not too many days later, she, okay, I'll do the training, and when is it? So how do you respond to that? On its face, at least, that sounds like, given that short period of suspension until you get the training, then you're welcome back.
Ms. Audio testified that she would not have missed any work if she would have agreed to do the training. She says, let me just find it. She didn't work until the next week anyway, so in between there, she could have had training in place and put in place, and that's on page 34 of the transcript. And so they discussed that it would not have interfered with her normal schedule and that she would indeed have been allowed to continue working if she would have started the training program. So while it can be construed as a suspension, if you just look at Ms. Van Der Veer's testimony, the unemployment law judge actually credited the employer's testimony, Ms. Audio's testimony, and her testimony is that she would not have missed any work shifts because she was required to do the training had she agreed to the training on September 12th. But on September 12th, she said she wasn't interested in the training, and that's the reason that no training was scheduled for her.
Does the record indicate what the timing of her subsequent follow-up text or email, whatever it was, where she now wants to do the training and when she was next scheduled to work?
that it is disputed in the record when precisely she said she wanted to come back. Ms. Vanderveer's testimony is that it's 2 days, but Ms. Audio, she said it was a week and a half to 2 weeks later. And important in that time frame is the trainer has vacation scheduled at that later point. So it's an extra complication in getting her scheduled for the training when she requested it after September 12th.
How was the separation from employment ultimately documented by the employer?
That I don't know. I don't believe that's in the record. As to whether what date or how they construed it.
Yeah, when did the employment end, according to the employer?
There's
paperwork, there are things that happen that sort of document that an employee no longer works here. Is any of that in the record that would indicate, well, as soon as she said she wasn't doing training, the employer started to fill out paperwork, formalizing her discharge from employment?
That's not in the record. They do say that the last day she worked is September 12th.
Okay, but that was September 12th.
Right.
She said, I'm not doing training, but then she's not scheduled to work for several days.
Correct.
And then calls and says, I'll do the training, and they say offer is no longer on the table for training.
After the training was supposed, after her next shift was supposed to start, it's sometime after that she
okay.
says.
So is what you're telling me the record shows that she actually missed a shift because she hadn't done the training that the employer required?
Yes. So Ms. Audio's testimony is that it was at least a week and a half to 2 weeks after September 12th.
That she called and said, I'll do the training.
Yes.
And in that time, she missed scheduled shifts.
And Ms. Audio also testified that she didn't work until the next week. And I believe there's evidence in the record that they replaced her on September 16th.
My question is, just to make sure I'm as clear as I can be.
Yep.
Does the record show that at the point when she contacted the employer to say that she would do the training, at that point in time, she had already missed a scheduled shift?
From Ms. Audio's testimony, the timing makes the most sense to interpret it as, yes, she would have missed a shift.
Why do we have to interpret her testimony? Why don't we have records from the employer offered at the hearing to say, here's our schedule, she was supposed to work this day, she didn't show up, and then she called a couple days later to say, okay, I'll do the training?
That's not in the record, unfortunately.
Understood. Did the ULJ make a finding to that point? Made a finding as to the quit, the day or the day they determined to be quit, but that on that very issue, was there a finding by the judge as to when she was next scheduled and when she, in relation
no.
to the content?
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt there. No, there is no finding as to what happened after September 12th in terms of when she was scheduled.
You believe that could be legally critical, depending on which side of that issue the record and or the judge would have found?
No, I don't, because on September 12th, Ms. Vanderveer knows that to continue in her employment, she needs to attend training. And at that point, she chooses not to accept that training. I guess it's arguable that you could say she was suspended until she did the training. But even then, while she was on that suspension, if you choose to interpret it as such, and I don't agree with that position, but if this court agrees that she was suspended, she quit while she was on that suspension. She made the choice not to have that training scheduled and to end the employment rather than attending any training that's scheduled.
How can you say that? If you just said, okay, if we presume that she was suspended, at the point when she says, well, I don't want to do training, she's now in suspension status. And you're saying at some point that turned into a quit because she, why did it turn into a quit? At what point and for what reason?
When she says, I don't want the training, I don't want to work at this place anymore, it's too toxic, there's no point
okay.
in the employer.
So, all right, but let's say she says that, but that's not a quit. That puts her on suspension status. At what point does she then go to quit status?
I would say that if you credit her testimony, which the ULJ didn't, that somebody told her she was suspended until she started training, that's what put her on the suspension status. And then when she says,
I'm sorry, I don't want to take you too far down. I thought I heard you say that, well, even if she had been in suspension status at some point, she then quit.
So, yeah, I did. But the place at which she quit is when she says, this is too toxic, I don't want to work in this place anymore, and I'm not doing the training.
Well, then she never would have been on suspension status. It would have just been a quit from the get-go.
Well, her testimony, which the judge didn't credit, is that she was placed on suspension before this conversation happened.
Before, okay.
But...
Can I just ask a question about this? I'm going to ask related the same question. Mm-hmm. At addendum 45, she was asked, didn't you decline training on September 12th? And she said yes. But then a day or two later, I asked for training. When she filled out her request for information in connection with her benefits application, she put down the end date of her employment as September 12th. That is the last day she indicated of her employment. That's her end date. Then she also said that she was suspended on that date. Mm-hmm. I don't know what all of this means except that that's what we have in the record.
I agree that September 12th was her last date, and that's the same date that was the last date that she worked and the last day of employment.
So the employer didn't dispute that in connection with her application?
No. No. Now, in regards to her quitting because of a good reason caused by the employer, it's incorrect that the employer did not respond to her concerns. They asked that she attend training, or required that she attend training. And in this case, it's not coworkers who are allegedly treating her inappropriately. It's the people that she's being paid to care for. In her own testimony, she admits that she did not act always appropriately in front of them and admitted to using inappropriate language in front of them. Given that she admits to swearing at them, and that she said one of them should be hosed down, and that one of them should be put in jail, it was reasonable for the employer to assume that she needed additional help in managing the behavior of these individuals that she's being paid to care for.
Ms. Froelich, do you agree with the statement that Mr. Chambers made that as a matter of law, there can be a situation such as here where the clause is created by the residents for whom she's caring for? Even though you might disagree factually here, and maybe the ULAJ did, could that not be a cause basis upon which a reasonable person would decide to quit?
It could happen that the behavior is so serious. For instance, if there is a physical threat, and the employer is refusing to provide safety or some sort of security, that might happen. But that's not the case here. And in part, it's because her conduct is contributing to that behavior. And that is a finding found by the judge, that Ms. Vanderveer's conduct exacerbated the behavioral problems that she was then forced to deal with by those residents. So she is part of the cause that's making this circumstance so egregious to her.
Is there anything in the record that Mr. Chambers, I believe that was the individual that was referenced, who she previously told us to, responded in some way to her concern?
To Mr. Hammer, the supervisor,
Nothing.
There's nothing specifically that lists what he did or didn't do, if he responded or didn't. That's not in the record to show if there was any action taken previous to September 12th. But I do want to emphasize that I do disagree with the characterization of asking her to attend training as not responding to the issue, because it is going to help her if she gets more training. And asking her to attend training is not adverse to her. She's going to be paid for it. They're going to pay her, or they're going to pay for the training. That in itself is not adverse to her. Finally, she quits the employment on September 12th because it's allegedly too toxic, and yet admits that she asked to come back at some point. So if it was so bad to compel the average reasonable person to quit and become unemployed, the average reasonable worker would not request to go back to that employment. And that that shows that, in fact, it couldn't have been that bad, or she wouldn't have requested to return. Finally, with regard to the statutory construction directive found in the Minnesota statute. In Wilson versus Mortgage Resource Center, the Supreme Court said both the language that referred to remedial nature and the narrowly construed were inapplicable to that case as it was not ambiguous. There's no allegation that the statute is ambiguous here, and this court has ruled on the statutes at hand many times. As such, that statutory construction directive is inapplicable here in the same way it is in Nicholson. With that, we ask that this court to affirm the decision of the unemployment law judge and find that Ms. Vanderveer quit the employment and did not quit it because of a good reason caused by the employer. Thank you.
I'd like to start by briefly responding to one of opposing counsel's last points about whether, as a matter of law, behaviors by residents of a group home can be adverse conditions, good reasons to compel an average worker to quit. And opposing counsel agrees there can be some situations as a matter of law where it is so serious, where there's a physical threat or a safety threat at the home, and that's exactly what we have here, supported by the record.
Where is that in the record? That there were actual concerns raised about physical safety, because I realize that in the information provided by your client to the to Deed, she said, "I'm very tired of the state enabling and supporting criminal and abusive behavior from its dependents. Staff are not invulnerable, and criminals belong in jail, not tormenting people who are trying to work and do good." But I don't see anything in any of the information that she provided that indicated a safety concern. I mean, she describes the people as malicious and and you know, clearly their behaviors would strike an average person as being obnoxious. But she talks about a punch, that they punch staff in the face, but I don't think she indicated that she was threatened with that.
Your Honor, it's unclear whether she was punched in the face or whether she's just referring to other staff being punched in the face, but I have a few responses to your point. Number one, I'd like to reiterate, safety is not the standard in the statute or the case law. It's about compelling a reasonable average worker to quit. Number two, Ms. Vanderveer did state in her response to that request for information, and I believe that's Exhibit 3, Addendum 53 to 54, that she did fear for her safety. She mentioned the unsafe environment due to the daily spreading of feces by that resident, and we would submit that is an unsafe condition.
Okay, and I'd also let me have to back up for a second. I mean, we've got a finding by the ULJ that the residents are mentally ill, in need of significant care, and have significant behavioral problems. That's not being challenged. What in the record, other than hosing people off and outside and so forth, what does the record tell us about what your client suggested to her employer should be done that wasn't being done to change this population's behavior?
Yes, Your Honor. So a few points. Number one, the statute and case law don't require the employee to specifically come up with the solutions. They require a complaint to the employer, and it's on the employer to address and resolve and give reasonable expectation that the adverse conditions are going to be improved.
But
second,
what if it's a case like this where there is nothing the employer can do? You're talking about a body of case law where we're dealing with people who don't have mental health or behavior issues and saying, okay, the employer has to, and they can discharge those people. Here we've got people that are living in a group home with no other options. They're there precisely because of the behaviors they have, and you're suggesting that somehow the employer at that group home has an obligation to change the behavior of the residents to accommodate the concerns of an employee.
They do, Your Honor, for a few reasons. Number one, it's not correct that there are no other options. Ms. Vanderveer did suggest putting this resident in a different facility, one that would be better equipped, and separating that from the hosing off comment, that is a reasonable suggestion to have a better equipped facility. That's not just one staff member trying to deal with residents. And by the way, the record supports this wasn't just an accidental behavior by this resident. It supports that it was, and it's undisputed, that it was willful and purposeful. When this resident didn't get his way, he would spread his feces around Ms. Vanderveer's workplace. That's something that can't...
mentally ill resident.
That's correct. And we aren't submitting that it's blameworthy, but there are ways to address that. Perhaps better staffing between the shifts, a different facility that's better equipped. Something other than only blaming Ms. Vanderveer and asking her to go through training. There's something that can be done, too.
But isn't the point of training that it might just be that these are the conditions at this sort of facility? This is just how it is. Just like in prison. It's very dangerous. You're dealing with a very dangerous population. You have risks of injury. You can't say, well, move the prisoners somewhere else so I feel safer at work.
Certainly, Your Honor, but there, if I may answer your question, there are measures that can be taken, perhaps, to move a certain prisoner, in your example, or to move a resident to a different area of the facility, to increase staffing, to increase measures, to stop purposeful, willful behavior that's causing a safety risk and that's causing a very serious adverse condition.
Can you say it's purposeful, willful behavior if the person is mentally ill? Isn't that the antithesis of purposeful behavior?
That may be, but it doesn't mean there aren't measures that can't be taken to try to address or improve those conditions.
Why don't you take another minute to wrap up?
Thank you, Your Honor. One last point I'd like to make about those adverse conditions is the record is also undisputed that Ms. Vanderveer is a 12-year veteran of these group homes. She's not a novice. She's not inexperienced. She's not someone new who's just having a tough time with typically difficult conditions. We submit these are fairly extreme conditions when there's this type of spreading of unsafe material around. And so I think the key point in both this case and a lot of the case law is not just the circumstances of the behavior adverse conditions, but also a complaint being made and the employer refusing to address it and give reasonable assurance that it will be improved, and that's what we have here. Right. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The matter has been well argued. It is taken under advisement.